Welcome to week 5. We're still working through the difficult conversations. Just announcement before we start. So this week is actually the last one of this particular series of difficult conversations, but it's not the end of the term. So what we're going to do next week is we're going to begin a new series, just a 3-part series, a short series, which is a little bit different. We're going to call the 3 moral and ethical dilemmas. We're going to take 3 scenarios, which are ethical, moral dilemma situations, and try to work through them with a bit of a Jewish perspective and understand how they relate generally to our own personal growth. So that'll just be 3 different weeks, 3 different scenarios over the next few weeks, the next 3 weeks. Okay, so we've been working through the last number of weeks, we've been working through these concepts of difficult conversations. Just to review, we've developed that there's three kinds of categories of difficult conversations. One was confrontation, which you worked through, response to conflict, diffusing conflict, and so on. The other one is a difficult one that could lead to confrontation, which we dealt with last week. And today, we're going to move on to a different kind of conversation, but nevertheless also a difficult one. One that also follows very much of the same principles of general communication and general conversations, the principles that we've been working through over the last number of weeks. But nevertheless, it's in a separate category, and I've called it awkward conversations. And ones we're difficult to have because we're insecure, or they might affect our own image, and so on and so forth. And the way I sort of like to define for today awkward conversations is the kind of conversation we don't have because we don't know what to say. Okay. And this is a very common thing. We know we need to have some sort of conversation, we're just not sure what to say. So sometimes we opt out and we just don't have it. And it's normally in the face of adversity, or the face of tragedy, or the face of things that have gone wrong. So for example, if someone suffers a very severe loss, or in a tragic situation particularly, where it's a big shock to everyone and a shock to the community, or a shock to the person themselves, and we're just not sure what to say or what to do. It could be someone who's been diagnosed, God forbid, with a serious illness. It could be someone who's just going through a very, very rough time, someone who's in trouble financially, legally, whatever the case is, and we're close to them, or we're friendly with them, and kind of awkward, we just don't know what to say. It's a new thing, it's a new shock, and we're just embarrassed, we don't know what the right words are, right? Or someone has gone through a divorce, or perhaps a sudden divorce, a sudden conflict in the marriage, or problems with children, and these kind of things. Now, what we're going to give today is some general principles, but understanding, of course, that everyone is different, and that's an important thing to understand. Everyone responds differently, everyone has different needs, everyone wants something different, so it's not uniform, it doesn't always work for everyone, but we're just going to try and establish the general principles. Now, these conversations follow very much the same principles we've been talking about till now, but in fact, they kind of need an overdose of the principles and the foundations of healthy conversations that we've talked about previously, because these kind of conversations normally need a lot of wisdom. We're going to see in a moment why these conversations are so necessary, on the one hand. On the other hand, if we have them wrong, we mess them up completely. And therefore, it needs a very, very careful balance. It needs a lot of wisdom. We need to know what to say, when to say it, if to say it, and so on and so forth. And these things need a lot of thought, a lot of preparation, and a lot of processing, and tapping into the foundations of what real human communication is really all about. Lost one of us. Okay, we'll have to make them up. give me 1 second. Sorry. Okay, sorry about that. Gosh. Okay, found them. So I'll just tell you a little story of, I think I might have mentioned the story before, just to give you an idea of what I'm talking about. There's a story, there's a saying in the Talmud, and it's a passage in the Talmud where it talks about the value of silence sometimes as opposed to talking. And the Talmud has a phrase where it says, Mila besela shtika betrei, which means a word is worth a coin, but silence is worth two coins. So in other words, silence is better, right? So once a story when someone was having an audience, someone was in a private audience with the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and the Rebbe wanted him to share some information which he was uncomfortable sharing. But he was in great respect for the Rebbe, didn't know what to do, how to get out of it, so he thought if he quotes a passage from the Talmud, then he's in safe ground, right? I mean, the Rebbe can't argue with the Talmud kind of thing. So the Rebbe asked him for this information, and he said to the Rebbe, a word is worth coin, silence is worth two. So the Rebbe smiled at him and said, no, you don't understand what the passage means, because your maths is wrong. A word is worth a coin, silence is worth two, but you only be silent once. But if you talk, every word is worth a coin, so it's worth more. Right? It's a clever way of saying it doesn't apply here. Uh-huh. The concept I'm trying to bring out is that both are true. Obviously, the Talmud doesn't really mean that. I mean, there's a simple meaning of the passage of the Talmud, that sometimes silence is dolen, as they say, right? But that's the dilemma. That's the dilemma. Sometimes silence is what we need. In fact, we'll see later that sometimes silence is a form of conversation, if it's done in the right way. Sometimes silence is a bad form of conversation. My sister-in-law in America has a good Yiddish saying from her mother, and when people talk and suddenly someone goes silent, so she says, "Was schweigst du so hoch?" Which means, "Why are you silent so loudly?" That's kind of a bad form of silence. You know? Sometimes someone is silent; they're saying so much without saying anything, right? But sometimes silence is a good thing, and sometimes not. And it takes a lot of wisdom to understand which one is which. And in fact, I'm going to share with you a concept which we've touched on before, but I'm going to put it into a Shavuot context. Because, in a few days, we're celebrating Shavuot. Sunday and Monday is Shavuot, the festival of Shavuot. A key central festival in Jewish tradition. Because it's the time we got the Torah, time that God gave us the Torah, Mount Sinai. Just to digress for a moment, it's an interesting festival, Shavuot. It's almost sometimes ignored, unfortunately, because it doesn't have so much cultural ritual to it, like Pesach has the Seder, Matzah, Sukkot has the sitting in the Sukkah and the shaking of the love, and Shavuot doesn't really have. And they say a joke, they say like this, that God gave us three festivals, Pesach, Shavuot, and Sukkot. In Israel, Shavuot is only one day, of course, publicly. It's only in diaspora, it's 2 days. So they say like this, there's three festivals, Pesach, Shavuot, and Sukkot. Pesach, God gave us a festival where you can't eat what you want. Sukkot is a festival where you can't eat where you want. And then God finally gave us a festival where you can eat what you want and where you want, but it's only one day. Anyway, so it doesn't have any specific mitzvot to it, but it's a very fundamental festival because it's really our identity. Our identity comes from Mount Sinai. That's when we became God's nation. That's when we received the Torah and so on and so forth. But although it doesn't have any particular mitzvot, it's got customs to it, many, many customs. One of the key customs, of course, to do with food, because us Jews cannot really pass a festival without something to do with food. So one of the customs of Shavuot is eating milk products, right? Milk products, cheesecake, linses, and so on. Why do we eat milk products? There's many, many reasons given for this custom. It's a very deep custom, actually, and there's many, many reasons, and it deserves a discussion on its own. But one of the reasons is because the Torah is compared to milk. One of the many, many reasons. One of the reasons is that, and the way it's done in some communities, in fact, is that it doesn't substitute the traditional festive meat meal, which is normally done in festivals, but it's in addition. So what people do on the Shavuot, on the Sunday, after davening, after going to shul and listening to the Ten Commandments and so on, they come back home, they make kiddush and they eat milk, then they stop and wait a little bit because you've got to keep them separate, and then you eat meat, right? The idea being actually to emphasize the mitzvah of separating meat and milk. Why? So I'll just tell you the background to it, because there's a medrash that says that when Moses went up on Mount Sinai to receive the Torah, the angel stopped him. And the angel said to him, what are you doing here? And he said, I've come to receive the Torah. And God said, and they said to God, why are you giving Moses the Torah? Give it to us. Give it to the angels. So God said to Moses, you're on your own. You better answer something. You better come up with a good answer. So Moses, according to one version of the Midrash, Moses turned to the angel. And he said to him, and he said to them, you can't receive the Torah because you broke the Torah. How so? If you look in the Chumash, in the story, when the angels went to Abraham, when they appeared, the three angels came to Abraham when after his circumcision. So it says that Abraham prepared a whole meal for them. And if you look in the verses, it looks like that he prepared milk and butter for them, and he prepared meat. So he says, when you went to Abraham's tent and you ate a meal, you broke the Torah. You ate meat and milk together, which was a violation of the Torah. So therefore, forget about the Torah. We need to get the Torah. So therefore, the custom became that because the mitzvah, which actually secured us the Torah, so to speak, was the mitzvah of meat and milk, keeping meat and milk separate, therefore we do it on Shavuot. We eat milk and then we eat meat to keep them separate. That's on one level. But on a deeper level, the actual concept of meat and milk and keeping it separate is actually a very important idea. It's a critical foundation in human growth and in our whole connection to Mount Sinai experience, the Torah, and so on. Why? Because Kabbalistically there's a concept of meat and milk. There's a concept that of why we actually keep the mitzvah of keeping meat and milk separate. And one of the ideas behind it is as follows. We've talked about this many, many times, that the two primary emotions of a person are chesed and gvura. So chesed being love, flexibility, connection, attraction, giving, compassion, all of these things that have to do with connecting to other people. That's chesed. And gvura is withholding, discipline, rigidity, inflexibility, inner discipline, restraint, holding back. All of these things have to do with gvura, good or bad. It's good chesed, bad chesed, good gvura, bad gvura, right? So the concept of meat and milk is, Kabbalistically, we know that meat and milk are both two very important things, because milk represents chesed and meat represents gvura. The reason being, milk is white and it's pure, it's soft, it's baby food, that's the idea of chesed and kindness, softness. Whereas meat is fiery, it's red. It's the concept of gvura. Fire is always synonymous with gvura. So meat and milk are very important because a person has to have chesed and gvura. There's a time to give, there's a time to hold back, there's a time to be flexible, there's a time to be disciplined, and so on. However, the Torah says a very interesting thing. The concept is that we shouldn't mix them. Why shouldn't we mix them? Not that chesed and gvura can't coexist, but the concept behind not mixing them is this idea. It's the idea of that chesed and gvura are two very distinct emotions. And it takes a lot of clarity to know when to use what. When we should use chesed, when we should use gvura. Often what happens is that we distort them. We know we have to use chesed and gvura, but we mix them up. We make what's called in Yiddish a big cholent out of the whole thing. So it's, the lines are blurred and we distort the values and we mix them up together and we don't use them in the right area. So the Torah says when you have chesed and you have gvura, you first need to know what each one is separately. You need to know what is chesed, you need to know what is gvura, and you need to know when to use chesed and when to use gvura. And in the case of difficult conversations, particularly these kind of difficult conversations, where we're not sure what to say, the wisdom that we need is a very much a wisdom of chesed and gvura. Chesed is when we talk, we're giving conversation, we're giving words. Gvura is when we hold back, when we're silent. And we need to know what are the things we have to have chesed, what are the things we have to say, and those things we have to say properly. The things we have to say with confidence, we have to say with security. Don't mix them with gvura. Don't mix them with holding back. It's got to say it properly. Things that are gvura, the things that we're not to say, the things we have to be silent about and hold back, or the times we have to hold back, have to also be done with firmness, not ambivalence. And that's the concept of keeping chesed and gvura separate. So I thought I'd share that with you because it's very much connected with the upcoming festival. Okay, so let's develop this whole idea. So previously we developed this concept we call the foundations of conversation, right? And one of the foundations of the conversation is that we can't really avoid difficult conversations. So let's bring that in to this type of conversation. Because we need to talk about a balance between protection of privacy and connection to other people. What do I mean? You know, on the one hand, there's nothing worse, particularly when a person is going through a difficult time, a tragedy, a sickness, a loss, whatever the case is, there's nothing worse than having your privacy invaded by people who are yentas and nudniks and people just need to know everything, right? people like sometimes just to be on their own. They need space. Space is a big thing. They maybe welcome some company, some conversation, but need their space. And respect of privacy is a very, very important thing on all levels. You know, it's an interesting thing. In the Chumash, we have a story of Bilam, the prophet, the non-Jewish prophet who the anti-Semite Balak employed to come and curse the Jewish people. And he warned him. He warned Balak that, listen, I'm actually in the hands of God, so I won't be able to curse the Jewish people if God doesn't let me. But not only didn't he curse the Jewish people when he came, it's the famous story in the Chumash, he ended up blessing them, so the curses turned to blessings. And it comes in different parts in the Chumash. One of the parts, we find the interesting thing. He says he went up on the mountain. Balak took him on the mountain. He wanted to show him the Jewish people. What that means is he wanted to show him the threat. You see this whole nation of 3 million people have just come out of Egypt and they all of a sudden popped up in the region. They're a threat to all the neighboring nations. You've got to help me with them. And he believed that Bilam had these powers to be able to curse and the curse would come true and would annihilate us and so on. So he asked, he took him up to the mountain. He showed him the whole nation, an overall view, an overview of the entire Jewish population. He said, go for it. And it says in the Pasuk, it says in the verse that Bilam had a look and he saw the Jewish people dwelling in their tents. And suddenly the Spirit of God came upon him and he started to bless them instead of cursing them. So this is the written Torah. What's the interpretation? What went on there? So the Talmud tells us the following. He saw an amazing thing happening. He saw blessing. Why did he see blessing? Because he saw how a camping nation, a nation who had just come out of Egypt, who had no permanent structure to live in, and they were all camping in tents, he saw how these 3 million people had erected their tents in a very specific way. How? They had these thousands and thousands and thousands of tents, right? They erected these tents in such a way where a tent has an open door, right? That the doors of the tent never faced a door of another tent. They were all structured in such a way that all the doors were not facing the doors of the other. The modesty, the privacy, the respect of privacy. When he saw that, he saw an incredible blessing. And he couldn't curse them, he had to bless them. Right? Because respect of privacy is considered a very, very important thing. You know, in the Talmud there's a legal discussion, a very fascinating legal discussion. If me and you share a courtyard and the wall falls down, and now there's still some sort of boundary there, so we know which part of the courtyard is mine, which part of the courtyard is yours. So the laws of neighbors, can one neighbor force the other neighbor to participate in the expense of rebuilding a wall? The other neighbor says, listen, I don't need the wall, I'm fine. I'm fine like this. So the halakha is, the law is that you can force, neighbors can force each other to participate in the expense of rebuilding the wall, a suitable wall that at least is high enough that they can't see into each other. Because the Talmud refers to it as hezek re'iyah, which means damage that comes from spying on others. Damage that comes from looking into others, from invading other people's privacy. There's no physical damage. You're not allowed to damage your neighbor. You can't do anything. You can't plant a tree in such a way that the roots will go into the other person's courtyard and damage their property. All these kind of things we have, laws of damages. But this is non-tangible damage. Non-tangible damage, the Talmud says, is when you invade someone's privacy, when you look at someone's affairs when they don't want you to. But on a more figurative level, the same thing is just regard to conversations in difficult situations. Sometimes people need space. Sometimes they need a virtual wall. They just need to be left alone so that they can process their own thoughts, they can work through their own issues, and they don't want everyone having long conversations with them or invading their privacy. So on the one hand, that's a very, very important thing, which is why sometimes people hold back in times of difficulty and they won't have conversations, they won't pick up a phone, or they won't go and visit the person because they're scared. It's well-meaning. They're scared to invade their privacy. Maybe they need to be left alone. Maybe we don't need to intrude. The problem is this. The problem is that at the same time, there has to be a very big balance. Because at the same time that it's so important not to invade someone's privacy, it's also important not to create a scenario where people suddenly feel a sense of loneliness. Because loneliness is just as bad as having your privacy invaded. And it's interesting, but if you read about this topic and you talk to people who have gone through difficult situations, especially sudden situations, people often complain that suddenly they felt very alone. That suddenly people who they thought were very close to them, very friendly with them, were nowhere to be seen. nowhere to be heard from. Well-meaning, because they just didn't know what to say, so they didn't do it. But people have said, I thought this person was my friend. I've heard people tell me this. I thought people were close to me, and they haven't reached out. People need to have a sense that others are supporting them. People need to have a sense that others are there for them. So it's a, you get this difficult balance, a very difficult balance to know how much do I reach out so that people will know that I'm there for them, but at the same time, to know that I'm not invading, I'm not overstepping the boundary, and I'm not going into areas where I don't belong, and I'm not welcome, and I'm not invited to do. Right? And that balance is so important because in times of difficulty, what's so important is connection between people. That's what people are there for. That's what friends are there for. We are there to connect each other. We are there to support each other. Right? And connection, as we said the very first week, connection comes with conversation. Connection is the outcome of the gift of language. Language, communication, talking to each other is what creates a connection. And therefore, and someone has suddenly goes through a very difficult situation, someone is born with a child, God forbid, that is Down syndrome or a different illness, whatever the case is. And suddenly you don't know what to say to the person, so people become avoided. There's a very real thing, by the way. I don't know if you have experienced this or you know people that have experienced it. But it's a very real thing that people talk about being alone, having a sudden sense of incredible loneliness. Or sometimes people's social situation change. People go through a divorce, or people go through situations where they don't fit in suddenly socially to their regular group, and suddenly the friends aren't there for them. It's a very, very lonely feeling. It's a strong and intense feeling of isolation, which is very, very painful, and just exacerbates and adds to a situation that is already tragic, that is already negative, that is already painful. So achieving that balance is hard, and sometimes all it is something brief. You see, I think sometimes we realize, or we don't realize perhaps, that certain things can be achieved very quickly. Right? Often, if it's still raw and things are, or we don't know what to say, or we don't want to invade privacy, and we're very conscious of the person's protection of their own privacy or independence, whatever the case is, sometimes it's just something simple of picking up a phone or running around and just for 1 minute and saying, you know, I know you're going through a tough time. I just want you to know I'm thinking of you and I'm here if you need me. Sometimes as simple as that. It doesn't have to be long. It doesn't have to be lengthy. But the person needs to know that you are there for them. Right? So that's sort of the starting point. The starting point is that like all difficult conversations, awkward conversations, these type of conversations we're talking about today, are not ones that can be avoided. They're actually ones you have to confront eventually. I've also read, you know, I read a book about this, about people who have gone through different situations, and they say an interesting thing. They say, you know, if you didn't know how to do it at the beginning, do it later. It doesn't matter. Even if you do it a couple of months later, you know, a few months later, you pick up a phone and say, look, I know you went through something really bad or very difficult. I wasn't able to connect to you till now, but I want you to know I'm here for you, or wish you well, or wish you success, whatever the case is. You know, sometimes we say, oh, you know, I never got around to it. I never visited them when they were sitting shiva, whatever, so I'm not going to do it. It's not true. It's an interesting thing. Even in Jewish law, where it talks about the mitzvah of nichum aveid, the mitzvah of comforting a mourner, which we know primarily exists during the 7 days, the shiva period. But the Shulchan Aruch is very clear that if you didn't manage to do it in the 7 days, it actually goes on for a year. You can always fulfill that mitzvah for the entire year. But also, besides on a halachic level, it also sort of symbolizes the concept that if you didn't do it, there's always room to do it. People always need support. In fact, when people go through a loss, sometimes it's after that period where everyone has been buzzing around that the loneliness sets in and becomes even more difficult. And sometimes that's the time to connect. Whatever it is, but it's not a conversation we can avoid, otherwise we create a sense of loneliness. At the same time, it's got to be done with a lot of wisdom and with a lot of consciousness and awareness of protecting people's privacy and not invading their space. Which of course goes to the second and third foundation of difficult conversations that we established the very first week. And if you remember, the first week we talked about the concept of human conversation versus animal language. And human conversation means that the communication that we go through is about the other person, not about ourselves. Right? It's not signal sending that we're sending our signals, but it's about entering into the world and addressing the needs of the other person. So remembering that communication is about connection. Connection means connecting to a different reality, connecting to a different world, connecting to a different person. So what that means, in other words, is that this type of conversation has to follow a very simple formula. On the one hand, we have to have the conversation not to leave people alone, not to leave people feeling a sense of isolation, but at the same time, remember that the conversation is all about what they need and not about me. And when we work on that foundation, it's much easier to grow into the conversation and to figure out how the conversation needs to be led. And let's go through a lot of points with regard to this topic. Right? So if it's all about the needs of the other person, right? So first of all, you have to ask ourselves the question, are we the right person? Right? Reaching out to someone is normally done when they're going through a very difficult time, is normally done by a friend. Right? It's normally done by someone who has a sense of closeness. So there's a very big sense in knowing our own place. And sometimes we have to reflect. We need to know, is it my place? I don't want to leave them alone. I don't want to avoid the conversation just because it's difficult for me, so it's not about me. If I have to have the conversation, I will. If I have to drop around, I will. If I have to pick up a telephone, I will. But am I the right person? Is it my place? Is it my role? Would they... It's asking ourselves the question, putting ourselves in their mind. Would they appreciate if I made the contact? Am I close enough for that? This is a time where they need people close to them to reach out. I'm an acquaintance. I might have coffee with them, but is it right now? Maybe I need to wait a while. So that's the first question. Am I the right person? But again, the answer cannot be I'm not the right person. You see, you have to be very honest. The answer cannot be I'm not the right person really because you're uncomfortable having the conversation. That's not the reason, right? If the answer is I'm not the right person, it's because I'm not the right person for them, not because it's hard for me. If it's hard for me, I've got to do it anyway. But I'm not the right person for them, maybe. I won't be helping them. I won't be attending to their needs. The next part is timing. You know, we talked about timing of difficult conversations in confrontation. The same thing is here. Timing is so important. Difficult. These kind of conversations have to be had, but they don't have to be rushed. I've quoted what Pirkei Avot says in many, many instances. The Ethics of the Fathers tells us that in matters of confrontation, don't appease someone when they're angry. In matters of consoling someone and comforting someone, it says, do not comfort someone when the dead person is in front of them. What that means is when it's just the initial shock, right? There's a time to reach out. We know that even in modern literature, there's something they call the stages of grief. And the stages of grief, the first stage is shock, right? And shock is not a time for an in-depth conversation. Right? Shock is maybe a time just for very, very close family to be there. It's not a time. That's why we have this mitzvah halachically. We have the mitzvah called nichum avelim of comforting the mourner. It actually does not apply till after the funeral. Because the initial shock is time of complete silence. It's a time just to be alone. There is a time to be alone. Not for long periods, but there's a time just to let it sink in. Obviously, timing is a different thing. It's how long we have the conversation. You know, often we visit people in hospitals. You'll talk to people who get visited. And it's such a balance, right? You know, in Jewish tradition, the concept of bikur cholim, visiting someone when they're sick, is a very, very big mitzvah. We learn it from God. God visited Abraham 3 days after he had circumcision. But there's something else you learn from that story. That God made it very hot. You know, Abraham was a very, very hospitable guy. So he ran an inn, essentially. Everyone knew that Abraham's home was open home. He had 4 doors to his tent, symbolizing that it was completely open. Doesn't matter what direction you came from, you knew that in Abraham's house, you always get a meal. Right? And that's what Abraham's house looked like. It was a thoroughfare for guests, in and out, all the time. Right? So when he had the circumcision, because God asked him to at a very old age, and God asked him to fulfill this mitzvah of circumcising himself, it was a major surgery, ultimately. So God gave him time to recuperate. And it says on the third day, which is, according to the Talmud, the most painful day after an operation, particularly circumcision, apparently, for an adult, God made it extremely hot so that people wouldn't be walking around, so people wouldn't bother him. Because God knew, God came to visit him, because he figured he'd appreciate a visit from God. That was okay. But he didn't want people bothering him, right? So God made it incredibly hot. And it says, Abraham was sitting at the tent door, kechom hayom, it was very, very hot. Why did God make it hot? To keep people away. The problem was that Abraham was so hospitable that it bothered him. He needed guests. He craved this mitzvah of being hospitable. So God sent him angels in the form of human beings. In other words, it was about the needs of the person. It's an interesting formula we learned from this whole story. God said, I'm willing to keep them away for you if you need, but if you really want, I'll send you a few guests. Okay? And it's the same thing when we visit people. People are tired. People sometimes get a lot of guests. We'll come to a hospital and we'll see a lot of people. People will stay and stay and stay. mitzvah visiting someone is really, really important, but again, it's about the needs of the person. The Talmud says that when you visit someone who's sick, you alleviate, you take away, you remove part of their sickness. That's because you give them strength, you give them comfort, you're there for them. It's a sense of connection, a sense of togetherness, but not if you drive them crazy. Right? So people need to know. I mean, I think I've shared this with you before. I remember a number of years ago, in fact, it's coming up to the Yahrzeit, 6 years ago when I was sitting Shiva after my father. I'll never forget this because it was a lot of people came through. And it was the first time I'd gone through the experience personally. I mean, as apart from, you know, being engaged with other people that go through it. But I remember that it was like towards evening and there was people coming there and there was a couple of people that sat down. And it was dinner time. Now, it didn't bother me, actually. I couldn't care less to eat in front of people. But my mother wouldn't do that. I know that she just wouldn't do it, right? So we're waiting for this guy to leave. He just doesn't get the hint. So my brother brings my mother a plate of food. Right? So the plate of food is sitting in front of me. And she's not eating. I'm eating. I'm hungry. So I said, I figured, you know what? You want to sit here? Because I'm dead. I'm eating. Right? But she won't do that. And she's with a spoon. She's stirring. And I don't know what to do. I almost was going to... But I knew my mother would be upset. If she wouldn't be upset with that, I would actually have the guy to leave. But, like, you just have to have a sense. There's a sense... I mean, that's a very extreme case, but there's a sense of picking up the vibes, right? That's what human communication is about. It's about reading your audience. It's about reading the person who you're connecting to. It's about remembering that it's not about me, it's about them. I came there for them. I came there to make it better for them. That's the sole purpose of it. You come and you see people are tired. You need to know, okay, it can be very brief. Just, I'm here for you, just wanted to wish you well, and you leave. You see their mood of talking, stay longer. Depends who you are. Depends how close you are to them. I think I've mentioned many times the halakha, the amazing law that it says in Shulchan Aruch, when you visit someone who's in mourning, they're actually not supposed to initiate the conversation. You're actually supposed to wait for them to talk. And it's an amazing law because the concept behind it is that you're supposed to wait to gauge what they want to talk about. People who go through a very intense tragedy or intense loss sometimes want to talk about the loss, sometimes want to talk about the weather. They want a break. So therefore you wait for them to talk so you get the sense of where the conversation needs to go to. It's all about the signals. Picking up the vibes, picking up, reading what people need. Sometimes, and also about the personality of the person. Certain people just love constant company. Certain people need more space than others. It's about working it out. It's about knowing that the conversation is for them, right? And sometimes, I want to share with you a story. There's certain things that stick in your mind from when you're very young. And just like certain things always there in your memory. Because the conversation is not always about words. Sometimes you have to have a conversation, but it's not about what you say. I'll just share with you this experience because I was, I think, 17 at the time, or 16, 17. And was my grandmother passed away. I'll never forget this. And happened to be staying at our home because my grandfather had an operation. She wasn't well, and it was like a bit of a difficult time. So they moved into us. And one evening, my grandmother was in bed. My mother went to give her soup. I'll never forget that. She came screaming back because she was obviously unconscious. So we knew that things were difficult. And then just at that moment, a guy walks into the house. I won't say his name, some of you might know him, but it's a guy who lives in South Africa, a very close friend of the family. It just was like divine providence. He happened to walk in. And the ambulance came, took my grandmother, and then my mother went with this guy to the hospital, so he was there to take her mother to the hospital. And then unfortunately, my grandmother in hospital passed away. My uncle came around to the house to tell my grandfather. He was very, very distraught. And then a few minutes later, my mother returned back from hospital. And then things ensued. There was conversations, there was crying, there was pain, there was making phone calls, arrangements, and my grandfather. And this guy, this family friend, I'll never forget this because as a kid, it looked strange to me. He stayed and didn't say a word. Didn't say a word the whole time. Just was there in the corner, looking, waiting. And I think to myself as a kid, you don't realize the thing. I was thinking to myself, like, so why are you here if you're not saying anything? Like, so what are you doing? Like, and then an hour and a half, I remember later when things started to calm down and you kind of knew what's happening the next morning, etc. My grandfather walked over to this guy and gave him like a little hug and he says, you know, you're always here when we need you. And I'll never forget it. I was always thinking, like, I don't understand what the guy did. He didn't do anything. And I'll never forget because when you get older, you realize, right? The empathy that this guy had was amazing. The connection that he created just by being there was actually incredible, and he didn't say a word. That was the amazing. It was an intense conversation without saying a word. He knew he was needed, and he was. He was a tremendous support. He was just that he had that level of closeness to my grandfather particularly. he's a kind of reserved, quiet guy as it is, but he can make conversation if he needs to, but he didn't need to. It's what we call empathy. Empathy is about, you just know, the person feels that you're there for them. Okay. So that's part of understanding, the wisdom of understanding the chesed and the gevura. Knowing that you can't avoid it. Make a connection. Don't leave people alone. But gauge how the conversation has to go. And sometimes, the conversation is a conversation without words. Just about being there. Just about being available. Being there as a support. The other thing I think that's really important when we talk about the needs of other people is not to give advice. You ever seen people come into a hospital room to visit someone and do you have good doctors? Like, you sure? Oh, you got this disease because my uncle is a specialist in this area. You should really give him a call. You know what I'm saying? It's like unbelievable. And it's not a joke. People do this all the time. Right? And it's the most non-supportive thing you could do. People are not stupid. People have doctors. And if they need better medical advice, they know who to ask. They've got relatives. They've got people who are close to them. And if they're not, they'll find out who to ask. And if you really think that you know someone that is incredibly competent and maybe they're not aware of it, tell a family member. Don't tell the person. Don't tell the person who's going through a trouble. He or she needs support. They don't need to know that the care that they have is not good. Right? They need to feel secure. They need to know they're in the best care. They need to know that, right? That kind of thing. That's a really, really important thing. It's part of the conversation of that, having the conversation, but not doing it what's better for the person. A very big one, and I suppose I've thought about this many, many times as a rabbi particularly, is don't explain things. When people go through a very difficult conversation, even when they have questions, don't explain. Why? Because not everything has an explanation. In fact, a lot of things in life, particularly difficult things, even as very strong believing Jews, who believe that everything is from God and that God runs the world and that everything good or bad comes from Him ultimately and there's a bigger plan, He knows what He's doing, it doesn't mean that He lets us on in the secret. It doesn't mean that we understand. Sometimes when we try to explain things, it makes it so much worse. Number one. And number two, we need to understand a very, very important thing. People communicate from different parts of their personality. Sometimes, and this is also important just generally in conversation to understand, sometimes people communicate or ask a question that is not coming from the head, it's coming from the heart. And if you talk back to the head and not to the heart, you missed the whole point. You follow what I'm saying? And it's true with everything, by the way. It can be true just with little things. It can be true just in marriages. It can be true just in little conversations. Sometimes people complain about something. You know, they say the famous thing, they always talk about male and female conversation, for example, right? That the female will complain about something, the male will just give a solution. Because in a little bit it's like that also, because one part of the conversation is from the heart, one part of the head, they're not talking to each other. You've got to talk to the person at the level from where the conversation is coming. Right? If the conversation is coming from the heart, you can't answer to the head. It's not an intellectual question, it's a heart question. And sometimes the best answer is, I don't know, but I feel your pain, or I'm here for you. We all don't know. And not everything we don't know, and there is no explanation. And you're right to have the question, and it's fine to have the question. And having the question, by the way, particularly sometimes in Jewish theology, this becomes a bit of a problem because some people think that we don't have the answer to the question, that we need to have answers to questions in order to believe, and nothing's further from the truth. I don't know if I've ever told you the story. There's a beautiful story that a Holocaust survivor once shared with me about Jews that were in the camps. And one day in the camps, there was a bit of a relaxing in the regulations and in the severity of it because there was some sort of public holiday and the guards were off celebrating. There was kind of a bit more relaxed. And the Jews were sitting there and they were discussing what's going on and like how terrible this whole thing is. So one guy comes up and he says, you know, I got a plan. We have to call God to court. We've got to call God to what we call in Hebrew a din Torah. We've got to convene a beit din, convene a court and let's summons God, so to speak, to find out what's going on here. So they set up this Beit Din, this court of Jewish law. They had a representative of God there, and they summoned him, and there was a representative of the Jewish people. And they had this play of some sort, and they summoned God, and they asked him, the claim against God was, how can you do this to the Jewish people? How can you allow this to happen? And went on for a while, and then everyone said the different pieces they have to say. And then the Beit Din, the judges convened that little conference, and they came up with a ruling. And the ruling was that God is wrong. He shouldn't be doing this. He should not be bringing this tragedy upon the Jewish people. And as they said this, as they delivered their ruling, it was really late in the day, someone, one of the judges looked up, after he had said that God was wrong, he looked up and he saw the sun setting and he said, "Uy, it's getting late, we have to daven mincha." And it's a powerful story, because not everything we have to understand. And something God doesn't want us to understand. And it's important. It's such an important thing to bear in mind when we're having a conversation with someone, because to try to explain something is a terrible thing. Try to explain something, often what it does is it justifies what happens. And we don't need to justify it, because certain things are best left unanswered. In fact, as Jews we know, one of the most fundamental things that we exercise is faith, emunah, faith in God. Faith in God is stronger when we don't understand. It's not stronger when we understand. It's a mistake people make. When we understand, it means that our limited mind needs to understand, as if to say that if we don't understand, it's wrong. And if we don't understand, then I'm not going to believe as much. To believe means that I believe despite the fact that I don't understand. I believe that God is infinite, He's omnipresent, He's omnipotent, He sees a bigger picture. I'm not in that reality, I'm just like a little child to a parent who doesn't understand. But that strengthens the faith, doesn't weaken the faith. So sometimes, because I've had this experience, I guess as a rabbi, when you're talking to people who have gone through a difficult time, and of course, ask questions, and how could God do this? And you know, you have sometimes people tell you, "I'm angry with God." So my line is, it's good, because if you're angry with God, it means you have a relationship with Him. Right? So that's okay. I mean, obviously, we shouldn't be angry with God, but sometimes we are. We have emotional responses. But we get through that, we work through that, but we don't work through it by justifying Him. We don't work through by answering the questions. We don't know the answer to the question. We work through it by believing despite the fact that we don't understand, and getting through it, and getting stronger, and bouncing back, despite the fact that we don't understand. So when we're having a conversation, we're reaching out to people, and sometimes people will say to you, "But why?" And sometimes the person hearing the question, "Why?" will feel almost a responsibility, feel almost a need to answer the question. And that's a mistake. You don't need to answer the question. The question, number one, doesn't have an answer. Number two, the question is coming from the heart, not from the head. So giving an intellectual answer is not going to do the trick anyway. The best answer is, we don't know. It's painful. It's painful. Just to say, we don't know. It's painful. And the last thing in thinking about, and this is a big one, the last thing in thinking about a conversation we have to people who are in difficult times, thinking about the needs of the person, is don't give a silver lining. Don't say, at least he had a good life, or at least he didn't suffer or something, right? At least, as if, your pain is not that bad, you shouldn't be really crying that hard. It's like, what do you mean at least? The person is going through a difficult time. And people do this, by the way. You'll be surprised at things people say sometimes. I'm sure no one here, but the things people say are just absolutely crazy sometimes, right? And it's well-meaning a lot of times. Right? It's a very big difference, by the way, if the person themselves gives the silver lining. If you're visiting someone that's going through a very, very difficult time, an illness or a tragedy or a loss, whatever the case is, and you're there for the person without minimizing their pain in any way, and they will turn around to you and say, "I know I'm going through a very difficult illness, but I appreciate the blessings that God has given me. I have a good family still, I have a good life. I'll get through this." That's different. Then you nod and you support them through what they are saying. But don't offer the advice. Don't say, it's not so bad. Don't forget, you got a wife, you got a kids. You'll get through this. Yes, you're going to suffer the next 3 years, a lot of treatment, but you'll get through it, kind of thing. I mean, come on. Like, the guy's going through a real pain, right? That's not empathy. That's like not being there for them. It's funny, but unfortunately people do this, right? Yeah, that's right. Be all right. Or after a while you say, get yourself together, kind of thing, right? Time to pull yourself together. Guy's shattered. His whole world is shattered, but it's time to pull yourself together. And it's tough love. I'm going to be there for you. It's very different when someone comes to you for advice, if you're a very close person, and says, I don't know what to do. I've been going through this. It's really been 6 months. I just can't get myself together. I just can't, help me. That's different. They're reaching out to you. You've got to be conscious of what they're reaching out to you for. Then it's different how you respond. But to come and offer that kind of advice is very, very painful, and it's hurtful. It's hurtful to people. People just need empathy. People need to know that you're there for them. People need to know that. And also another thing is, I understand your pain. No, you don't. You've never been through it. What do you mean you understand? You don't understand anything. Right? Or you say, I've gone through something similar, and you say something completely different than you've gone through, which has no relevance to what they're going through, kind of thing. I'm saying, it hasn't even been, I had the flu last week, but they're going through something much more, that kind of thing. I don't mean that as silly as that, but so it's sometimes, I guess the point I'm making out is, we need to reach out, You can't avoid these conversations, but it has to be with a lot of wisdom. And sometimes the less said, the better. Be there for them. Reach out to them, but just be there for them, in for their needs. Don't overstay your welcome. Don't think about the timing. And do it in a way where they are supported. Always think about what's going to be better for them, and not what I want to know, not what information I want to know, or what I think is the right thing to do. What's going to be the best support and help for the person who's going through a difficult time. I'll just show you a little cute little video someone sent me the other day. It just fits into this. I'll just show it to you. On empathy.
So what is empathy, and why is it very different than sympathy? Empathy fuels connection. Sympathy drives disconnection. Empathy, it's very interesting. Teresa Wiseman is a nursing scholar who studied professions, very diverse professions, where empathy is relevant, and came up with four qualities of empathy. Perspective taking, the ability to take the perspective of another person or recognize their perspective as their truth. Staying out of judgment, not easy when you enjoy it as much as most of us do. Recognizing emotion in other people and then communicating that. Empathy is feeling with people. And to me, I always think of empathy as this kind of sacred space where someone's kind of in a deep hole and they shout out from the bottom and they say, I'm stuck, it's dark, I'm overwhelmed. And then we look and we say, hey, I'm down. I know what it's like down here, and you're not alone. Sympathy is, ooh, it's bad, uh-huh? No, you want a sandwich? Empathy is a choice, and it's a vulnerable choice, because in order to connect with you, I have to connect with something in myself that knows that feeling. Rarely, if ever, does an empathic response begin with at least. And we do it all the time. Because you know what? Someone just shared something with us that's incredibly painful, and we're trying to silver lining it. I don't think that's a verb, but I'm using it as one. We're trying to put the silver lining around it. So, I had a miscarriage. Oh, at least you know you can get pregnant. I think my marriage is falling apart. At least you have a marriage.
Yeah.
John's getting kicked out of school. At least Sarah is an A student. But one of the things we do sometimes in the face of very difficult conversations is we try to make things better. If I share something with you that's very difficult, I'd rather you say, I don't even know what to say right now, I'm just so glad you told me. Because the truth is, rarely can a response make something better. What makes something better is connection.
Yep. That kind of sums it up, I think. The thing that was mentioned in the video, which I didn't mention before, is this concept of judging. That's also something that people do. Like you don't say it sometimes, but you imply it. Person going through a sickness, you know, well, if you lead a healthy lifestyle, it might help, kind of thing. You know, that you don't say it quite like that, but you kind of imply it. So yes, all of that is not empathy. So I'll just end off with one thing, and again, coming back to Shavuot, which is this coming Sunday, Monday. There's a very interesting passage in Pirkei Avot, the Ethics of the Fathers, and it talks about the Torah. It talks about how we connect to the Torah. Shavuot is the time that God gave us the Torah. It's a time for commitment to greater learning and greater involvement in knowledge and so on. And the knowledge of the Torah, the divine knowledge, and the Pirkei Avot, Ethics of the Father, says, how do we connect to the Torah? How do we acquire Torah study? And the Mishnah says, the passage says that there's 48 ways, 48 things you have to do in order to really connect with Torah study. Now, if you look at some of these 48 things, some of them make a lot of sense on the surface. In other words, you know, you've got to listen, you've got to learn, you've got to discuss with others, you've got to analyze with others, all that kind of stuff makes a lot of sense. Then you have a group of things where it says, you know, you've got to also be able to give up some other things. You can't indulge and enjoy all the pleasures of life and expect to become a scholar. It doesn't work. You've got to be able to give up some things if you want to pursue the knowledge of study and so on. But then there's a couple of things here the Mishnah says which don't seem on the surface to have a direct connection to this concept. And one of them is a idea which is talked about in the Talmud. It's called Noseh Be'ol Im Chaviro. It means to share the load of another friend, which essentially is another way of saying empathy. It's this concept that we're talking about here and talk about in the video. That empathy, the Pirkei Avot says, is actually a pathway to acquiring knowledge. And it's very interesting, what's the connection? And I was thinking about it, and I think the connection is this. Because at the end of the day, it all goes to the heart of what communication is all about. When you can really empathize with someone, not sympathize, but empathize with someone, what that means is that you can actually go out of yourself. You can go out of yourself and you can enter the world of another person. You can be in the world, you can be in the space of another individual who's going through a challenging time. And that's difficult. To go out of ourselves is very difficult because, as we've talked about many times, by default we're kind of trapped in ourselves. To go out of ourselves, to the process of empathy, the process of learning to empathize with others in the face of challenge, or just generally to have empathic listening, to listen to others with empathy, to really understand, to re-enter their world, allows us to practice this concept of going beyond ourselves. When we learn to go beyond ourselves, it affects every part of our life, not just communication. It affects everything, it affects our growth altogether, because growth and knowledge, which was the Mishnah is discussing, is about knowledge. Knowledge is not just about learning more of the same. It's about being open to new ideas, to new concepts, to infinite ideas, things that are beyond my normal mode of thinking, not things that are not normally part of my mindset or my framework. When the Mishnah talks about the commitment to Torah study or becoming knowledgeable in Torah concepts, it doesn't mean just absorbing the things which I'm already comfortable with. It means challenging my thought process. It means going beyond myself to be able to learn things that are not directly in line with the way I normally think. So our emotions come into this. Normally, of course, learning is an intellectual exercise. But the Mishnah, the passage tells us that actually emotions have a lot to do with it. I guess what they call today emotional intelligence. Because what emotions do is they allow us to grow. If we have healthy emotions, and one of them being empathy, if we can actually have the emotion of empathy, which is to go beyond ourselves and put ourselves in the space of others, that will affect also our ability to learn and to study things that are beyond ourselves as well. And that becomes the connection between this concept and acquiring knowledge. So that's the concepts of difficult conversations. Again, we did this in 5 weeks. Of course, communication is a lifetime subject. But I'm just there to sort of highlight a few different concepts. I just want to again remind you that this was the last one of this particular series. Now we're going to do a 3-week short series on 3 scenarios of moral and ethical dilemmas. We're going to take just 3 different scenarios over the next 3 Thursdays and analyze them and see how they relate to our own personal growth as well. And in the meantime, to wish you Shabbat Shalom and Chag Sameach, and see you next week, hopefully. All the best. All the best. All the best.